Hello, I'm Priya Bates, President of Inner Strength Communication based in Toronto, Canada.
And I'm Adwita Patel, Director of Comms Rebel based in Manchester, UK.
And we're co-founders of A Leader Like Me.
We've also recently published a book with Kogan Page called Building a Culture of Inclusivity: Effective Internal Communication for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion.
In season three of our podcast, we will introduce you to diverse voices where we talk about the role of communication personally and professionally in building inclusive cultures.
We hope you enjoy our podcast. In today's episode, we have been very privileged to welcome Sharon Amusu. Sharon is a multi-award-winning motivational speaker, executive coach, and a leadership enthusiast. She's taken her 16 years from the courtroom as a criminal barrister to help organizational leaders to lead with courage and inspire their people to do the same. She's also a TEDx speaker on leadership, the founding member of the Society of Leadership Fellows at St. George's House, Windsor Castle, a former branch chair of the Institute of Directors, and has several non-executive director roles. As you can tell, Sharon has an incredible portfolio of experience, and this conversation that Priya and I had has been incredible. I hope you enjoy. Thank you so much, Sharon, for joining us today. The first question I would love to ask you is, how did you get into the world of inclusion following your incredibly successful career as a criminal barrister? For 16 years, I think I read you were doing that role. So what was that journey like for you?
It's really interesting. Thank you so much. And it's a real pleasure being here and having this conversation with you both. Thank you for the invitation. So the reality is that it's always featured. The world of diversity and inclusion, there's no sort of pre and post in relation to my career. The world of inclusion and being an advocate for inclusion has been a hallmark of my entire career. When I entered into the legal profession, I entered because I saw a world where there was disparity and there was injustice and there was inequity. And I grew up during the 70s and 80s in Greater Manchester, and in particular during the 1980s, there was a lot of civil unrest, in particular between Black Caribbean communities and law enforcement, but also within the education sector. And so, growing up in that environment and seeing real issues in relation to racial inequality, it was that really sparked my interest and my desire to enter into the legal profession and seek to be an advocate for change and a voice for change in that arena. Fast forward 16 years, I knew, having worked actually, so I did a lot of work with women who'd experienced domestic abuse when I was in practice. And that was really the springboard of me wanting to leave the profession and support leaders in organizations who are making key decisions about people's lives. And I knew that leadership development was a key piece, but also diversity and inclusion, because that was very much my background. And actually, for me, diversity and inclusion is about leadership. It's about creating leaders who build fair and healthy and high-performing workplaces and understand that being inclusive is the only way to go about achieving that.
Love that.
So you just talked about leadership. Can you tell us what do you think is the greatest challenge leaders face when it comes to inclusion?
I recall, thank you so much. I recall a quote, and I'm hopefully not bludgeoning it entirely, by Mahatma Gandhi. And he said that embracing diversity is both the beauty and the test of our civilization. And that's because the reality is, when you have a world where naturally we gravitate toward people who are like us, and that's our affinity biases, and that it makes sense because we understand that we feel safe around people who share our interests, have common backgrounds, and so on, then what you're actually asking people to do is step outside of that comfort that we all want. We like the security, we like knowing who we are and where we are, etc., and do that intentionally and reach out and connect with people who think differently to them, whose philosophies may grate, whose backgrounds may be unfamiliar. And you're asking them not only to work alongside them, but as leaders, to draw the best out of them. That's mm-hmm. a huge challenge. And so I see it with many leaders, that fear that paralyzes them. How do I hold a conversation? How do I bring feedback to people from diverse populations? How do I identify talent and not patronize? All of those things are real challenges that I see leaders facing in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, what you just shared there, Sharon, the similar concerns and challenges facing people in this inclusive culture space. You know, the folks that we've interviewed on our previous episodes talk a lot about fear and talk a lot about some of the challenges facing leaders. And Priya and I, you know, we always say to the people with the clients that we work with is that leaders are human beings as well. And I think sometimes people forget, and I know that's a really weird thing, but we expect our leader to be knowledgeable, confident, know everything about everything, and lead the way. And in my experience, and I'm sure it's in your experience as well, is that they often are frightened about getting it wrong. It's not that they are malicious and they don't want to have an inclusive culture and they don't want everyone to feel that they can thrive and belong and do the right stuff. But the point that you made there about bias, we all do feel comfortable with people who have similar lived experiences to us, because we feel the empathy that they may have about some of the struggles that we've gone through. And naturally, with no fault to anyone's really, because of the environment they're growing up with, you'd lean into that. And in our experience, encouraging leaders to be more courageous about their educational journey and understand why some of the decisions they're making are not equitable or fair is the first step to help them move away from that fearful conversation that we have. And I can imagine some of the discussions that you have with your leaders around courage, because I know you talk a lot about courage, and I've been very lucky to have seen you speak at several events, including my own, where you have captivated the audience with your storytelling and have left them in awe of some of the experiences and stuff. And I think you're such an incredible storyteller, which really resonates with Priya and I as, you know, as communication professionals. When you're trying to encourage leaders to be more courageous in terms of their next steps, how do you start that? So if anyone's listening to that who are struggling to build that relationship with those leaders to take that courageous step into this inclusive space, what would you recommend that they start with? Is it about storytelling, or is it what is it about that we get these leaders involved a little bit more and ask those curious questions?
Yeah, thank you so much. So you're so right. For all of the reasons that you've explained, Advita, there is real palpable fear about this. And we understand why that's the case. We are living in an incredibly open, accountable environment, aren't we? We've got the likes of social media, for example. We've got cancel culture. So if you say the wrong thing, then it means it's the end of your career and it's the end of your organization, or it's the end of whatever. And so all of those things make people much more tentative and wary and worrisome about speaking and about asking questions and about curiosity. But I would encourage, first of all, the acknowledgement of leaders who are wanting to step into this space, to understand that our fear, the fear that we have, doesn't make the issues go away. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make the need for diversity and inclusion disappear. It doesn't negate its value. And so, as with any other challenge in the workplace, whether it be the pace of change or globalization or AI, like, for example, AI is not going away. Technology is not going to disappear. And so what we have to do then is find our resolve within ourselves to be able to navigate the unknown. And in many ways, leaders, I often describe them as cartographers. So in the 15th century, cartographers were map makers, and 15th century maps, allegedly, they would have at various points that were yet uncharted, they'd have something which was often referred to as here be dragons. So it's really scary because we don't know it. And it was the courageous ones who would go into the unknown. And one of the things that I often find that they root themselves to, those leaders who go into that, first of all, they have a clear sense of purpose. They have a clear sense of knowing why this is important. And there's a great quote which says, when we know our why, then we fear less the how. If I know why this is important, why it's important for my organization, when I can connect not simply with the business imperative, which is clear and proven, but also the moral imperative, when I know why, there is nothing that will stop me. I will find a way through. And I think about myself as a parent, right? And there's a syndrome. I forget the name. The name escapes me. But it's like a superhero syndrome, which has caused some people, if they've seen their children in danger, to be able to lift cars. Like, it's like an adrenaline rush that helps them to do what needs to be done in the moment. And it means that fear, though real and tangible, becomes unimportant. And Audre Lorde talked about that. She said, when I'm clear about who I am, my purpose and what matters, it matters less whether I'm afraid. And so I encourage leaders to connect with their purpose. Why is this important for us right now? And then I'll be able, when I'm clearest to my own why, then I navigate the obstacles, I navigate the opposition, I navigate those barriers because I know why this is important. So connecting to purpose. And then also I encourage leaders to begin with the end in mind. It's that that age-old Stephen Covey principle, isn't it? Those who are most strategic and effective and impactful, they've got a vision. They've got a vision of a brighter future, a better day. They have a sense of hope and optimism for what is to come if we take this action. And they're able to bring people along with that vision. And do you know what I found? When leaders are able to communicate that vision and connect people to it with a passion and a fervor, then people are more forgiving of mistakes, right? When you're able to say, here's where we're going, I get things wrong, I will get things wrong, you will get things wrong. But when you're connected to that sense of purpose and you're able to connect people to it, when you're connected to that vision and the end of mind and you connect people to it, then people will buy into that and be more forgiving of errors.
I can just keep listening to you and not ask you any questions. Just keep talking, Sharon. It's just amazing to hear you speak. And mostly part of that is because you're reiterating so many of the things we talked about in our book. And our first chapter is all about talking amazing. About the why and, you know, really understanding what does that mean from a leadership perspective for the organization or the community or the group that you're leading. And I think the one thing that was interesting as we were doing the research for the book was that there was a conversation that was starting to appear on LinkedIn and social media about we shouldn't be asking why, we should just be doing it because it's the right thing to do, right? So we should lead with the right thing to do versus actually mapping it out to the business or organizational needs. How do you feel about that?
Yeah. So one of the things that strikes me about this, and it's much to your point earlier on about recognizing that the people who were asking to influence these decisions, to be allies, for example, are human beings, right? And for any of us, we need to, I feel sometimes, strip back to basic human principles of communication, which you will appreciate. How do you engage people? How do you get them to buy into your story? How do you get them to warm to you? If you're accusatory and pointing the finger and blasé and flippant about the sort of the obvious fact of it, right? We don't vote. We don't buy by logic. We buy with emotion. You'll know that as communication experts. And so it's getting back to the basic principles of human communication and connecting with people and moving people. And one of the most compelling reasons why people buy into stuff is because they subconsciously on some level, or even consciously on some level, there is this sense of this matters to me. I get this. It's important. And yes, there is There is, on the one hand, just do it whether or not you feel it, but there's also sustaining it. And what I feel has been an issue for some time is we've just gone for the just do it. And that can lead to tokenism. All right. So there's an external expectation. We've got a bit of a flow, a bit of a momentum, some traction, whether whatever it might be, whether it was George Floyd or we've got some kick it out in football racism in the UK. Priya, or cricket. So recently we've had real conversations about racism in cricket. And so there'll be a spike in the conversation and in the public discourse. And then it just completely subsides. And that's because people were not connected with the why on this. They were connected with what people said should be done. But actually the people that I have seen, the leaders who I've seen sustain momentum, and understood that this is not a fanciful affair. Actually, it's not just something that we do because it's convenient. We're doing it because we know it's right and it's good for our business. I'm not being at all reductive about that. It's good for business. The research is clear. Your book points that out explicitly. So there's not a compromise here. It's not a case of saying, let's do good, but your business will suffer. No, let's do good because your business will be great and your communities will be great. So I feel that actually the question that often comes with that, just do it because it's right. I feel sometimes, to your point, Priya, sometimes there's a disconnect from the reality of human connection and human relationships.
Yeah. Priya and I have spoken about this in detail and we agree with you. I think we need to find that connection and we need to, all of us, regardless of our characteristic and our demographic and our background, we can all be allies for different communities and different people. And we all have to find our why. And telling people just do it is never going to have longevity or leave a legacy at any point. And currently, while we're recording this, for our listeners, we're recording this episode with Sharon at the start of Black History Month in the UK. And one of the pushback I will always give organisations is, first of all, it should never just be a month, full stop. But also, what have you done since last October? Because it's October in the UK and it's February in the US. But what have you done, physically done, to improve the working life of your Black colleagues in your organisation since the last time you did a celebratory or awareness month for your black colleagues, your Black clients, your Black consumers? And if you haven't seen traction and change, then my question back to you is why? Why are you doing it? Is it to look good? Is it so you don't get shot down? Because the feedback I have from the colleagues who are being asked to contribute their stories to some of these awareness days, it's more harmful than it is doing any good. And I can't iterate enough that if you are going to do any awareness day about any marginalized community, think very carefully about the outcome you're trying to achieve and the difference that you want to make. And when you have this principle of just do it, it shouldn't be a question, that's when, to your point, Sharon, it becomes very tokenistic and it becomes harmful more than anything else. And you're lulling people into a false sense of security that they're going to be safe in that environment because this organization is publicly announcing the support for this community. And anyone who's listening, this is, and I can't say this enough, and Priya and I speak about this in our book, that be intentional with what you're trying to do and be open for feedback and constructive feedback from your colleague population without getting defensive. So thank you so much for sharing your insight on that, because it is something that we can get into a debate about with allies and with supporters who want inclusion to be embedded across everywhere. But like Priya said, we have to be mindful about the why behind it, and that's really important. So Sharon, one of the brilliant things that you do for our region in Greater Manchester, so I just want to explain, because we didn't do it at the start, so a barrister, because I know not, we have a global audience, is like a lawyer, because I know barristers don't exist, do they? Correct me if I'm wrong, but barristers don't exist in North America or in the US. So it's like a lawyer, so that's what Sharon did before. But your daughter is also following your footsteps into this legal profession. And a couple of years ago, both of you joined forces to create this incredible community called She Leads Legacy. which I absolutely adore the work you're doing in this space. Would you be able to tell our listeners a little bit more about the purpose behind Sheely's legacy and what's and also the work that you're doing with your daughter? Because I think that's so incredible about that legacy piece.
Thank you so much. So as I mentioned, I started out in the profession many moons ago. And when I started out, I was the first. So as a barrister in the UK, the location that you practice out of, right, your offices is called chambers. Yeah. And so when I joined my set of chambers, I was the only Black female in chambers. There's been lots of conversations that have taken place between that time and now as to equality, representation. And my daughter started out in practice. She's literally just qualified now in practicing personal injury and employment. So she's a personal injury and employment law barrister. And as she was on her journey entering into chambers, she looked around and she saw actually she was in exactly the same position in terms of representation entering chambers. There was no one else who looked like her. So we reflected between ourselves and we said, well, how is this possible? We've had lots of conversations. We've been talking about targets and metrics and how important it is for us to have greater representation at the criminal bar or whatever bar it is in practices, barristers, that those who are advocating for our communities actually are of those communities. And yet we're not seeing the movement. These numbers are stubborn. And so what we decided to do is have conversations reflecting on this between ourselves, first of all, and then having some focus groups with some friends and more broadly for Black women who were in our network and beyond. And we started hearing the same stories, that there were barriers, that there were obstacles, that their potential was not being realized, etc., that there was frustration. And what we decided was, rather than being, and I come from a kind of a campaigning family, Advita and Priya. So my dad, when I was growing up, formed something called the West Indian Parents Forum because of the number of Black boys in particular, Black children, but Black boys during the late 70s and 80s who were being excluded from the education system. And so he brought together parents to speak to those issues. So I sort of have that in my background, right? And so we were looking at it and thinking, right, so we can either just go, this is bad, it's not great, or we can seek to do something about it in our generation. And the thing that immediately resonated that came was the title, She Leads for Legacy, because the immediate obvious statement is, I am here, that's me, Mum, and looking at my journey, recognizing that despite the 20 odd years gap, we have still not made the progress. It's glacial. We've still not made the progress that we ought to have made. We still are rocking around the same issues. So She Leads for Legacy came about to advance and progress and accelerate Black women into senior leadership and board level positions. And what's very specific about our work is that that is done in partnership with allies. So throughout my entire career, what I am able to say and assert is that had it not been for allies, and it was, in all honesty, white male colleagues who saw potential in me and created opportunities, opened doors, pulled a chair to the table and said, we need your voice into this. It was them who were keen and really passionate advocates and sponsors when I wasn't in the room. There are countless examples that I can think of to that regard. And so it was clear to me that if we wanted to really effect meaningful change, we needed people at the table who were making those decisions, who could hear about those challenges, but also listen to the voices of those incredible women and then be a voice alongside in partnership for change. And also much of our hypothesis behind that was confirmed because we were able to secure some European funding. And commissioned Manchester University to produce a report looking at the experiences of Black women in the workplace. And one of the key things that emerged from that report by way of recommendation was having a network of Black women, a network of allies who are able to raise awareness, bring appropriate challenge, and really drive positive change together.
Now, you know, I'm speaking from with my North American hat on. A lot of the conversations, especially in the U.S., I'm in Canada, but south of the border, are about getting rid of things like affirmative action and treating equity as a bad word. We've had this conversation with quite a few of our podcast guests. Talk to me about equity versus equality. Is it people are saying, well, equity is not fair. Affirmative action is not fair. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, no, it's such an important question, Priya, because it was just, I was speaking to someone about it recently, and I was saying, okay, here is one way of looking at it. And it was a great example that was shared with me. Imagine that you go to, I think perhaps in the US, it's called Parents Conference. In the UK, it's called Parents Evening. And if you've got two children, and for one of those children, they may be twins, for one of those children, you go to the parents, teachers conference, the parents evening, and the teacher is saying to you, let's say Johnny is performing incredibly well, and he's very capable, very able, and all he needs is just continue as he is. He's doing incredibly well, well supported. He's an A-level student and everything's fine. And the other twin, Sammy, you go to the same parent teachers conference, parents association, and the teacher says, you know, Sammy's got some challenges when it comes to this particular subject. We've noticed that he's quite distracted. And so what we think is that he might need additional support. He might need a particular focus on this particular area. And then you go home as a parent, and what you do is you get a tutor for Sammy, and you spend extra time in the evening. And then Johnny comes along and he says, why are you giving Sammy more time? Like, is this fair? Is it fair for you to give Sammy more time? I'm your child as well. And in that moment, the parent is going to explain equity versus equality, because the parent could say, yeah, okay, I have now 10 hours in the evening per week. And what I'm going to do is give 5 to Johnny and 5 to Sammy. What that's going to do is widen the gap, because Johnny has had as much attention as Sammy, but didn't need it because he was already at an advantage. Whereas what we know is what's actually needed, based on what the teacher has said, Sammy needs more focus, needs more attention, needs that. And what wanting to know is that focus is not about exclusion. Focus is about supporting and leveling playing grounds. So that's what affirmative action is. And that's what we're talking about when we're referencing equity. It's about recognizing that the equivalent, really, it's a metaphor. What are the disadvantages that certain groups have not had? That if you simply give everyone the same thing, would simply widen the gap. Is it social capital, the network that you have? When I think about my own journey, when I started out in the profession, I knew no one in law at all. Whereas many of my colleagues, they had parents, their parents' parents' parents were practicing law, navigating university. I had no idea about navigating university. Even choices of modules for my law degree, I didn't know. And there were things that meant that I didn't progress as quickly because I just didn't know. And had there been programs, had there been awareness days that were specifically for people who had faced my areas of disadvantage, then that would have leveled the playing field. So I understand why people who don't appreciate the difference between equality and equity can get frustrated and say, why are you focusing in on one particular group? Why are you treating them a certain way? But I think when you bring it to almost a human understanding of everyday situations that everyone faces, and you think to yourself, do we not see equitable approaches in various ways? As a parent, do we not see that? Do we not have, I was recently at an event, and it was a meal, and it was a grand sort of family affair. And what they did is everyone had been waiting. And then when the meal was ready, it was a buffet. They called the diabetics first. Now, one might say, why would you call the diabetics first? Everyone's been waiting. Just let them all queue. But actually, you're mindful of the fact that they have a need. And if you don't meet their need, it's not that you're not favorable to everyone else or that they don't matter. It's that you'll provide, they're a special interest group, and you need to provide affirmative action to level the playing field.
We do that at dinner parties, don't we? Like it's Thanksgiving weekend. So we're going into Thanksgiving weekend here in Canada, not in the US. US is in November, but you let the children and the seniors eat first, don't you? Right. When Precisely. You have a buffet, it's something that it is exactly. very human. It's very natural. Yeah. I love that. And I think that, you know, some of the conversation and the rhetoric that is designed to create divisions also paints a picture that there's not enough for everyone. And I think that's part of the problem, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. It's that scarcity. And you hit the nail on the head, Priya. There's a scarcity. So there's not enough. There's insufficient. And it's going to run out. It's not going to run out. But also what it also assumes in some instances is that there is a right of some people to have something over another group of people. And if you open it up, then it means that this demographic is going to have less opportunity. Well, what that assumes is that you always should have had the opportunity. No, it always should have been fair. This is just making it fairer. It's bringing awareness and transparency. So you're so right. One is scarcity, but also sometimes what comes into that is this sense of entitlement. Mm.
That is so true. And it is one of those conversations that we do frequently have with people about, but why should they, you know, what's the purpose of that? It's not fair. You know, that word, it's not fair. And it is almost, you know, stopping the quickness of your mind and reflecting and stepping back and understanding the position that they're coming from and the position that you came from. And I relate hard with your story, Sharon, about going into a place where you're one of the first and trying to navigate your way through a complex system at times to understand what value you can bring into that space and what value you're taking away. And my parents didn't work in an office. No, they always worked for themselves ultimately. So when I had my first office job, I had no idea office politics and CEOs and CFOs and COOs and all this terminology that people throw out there. And I would say that I probably was on the back foot compared to most of the people in that room. And the distraction that you have when you're trying to catch up and you're already feeling different anyway from the dominant culture, it takes a lot of toll on your mental health. And I think that's when I always say to leaders and organizations that we work with is just put to your point, Sharon, put yourself in their shoes. Like just humanize their story and humanize who they are as individuals. And you'll see the difference that you can make when you become a true ally for that community. We always ask this question of our guests in terms of DEI. Do you believe that the light is dimming on DEI?
Oh my gosh, what a powerful question. I'd like to say that I'm a glass half full person. And my commitment is to believe and hope and to believe that the best is yet to come. Mm-hmm. Because I'm one of those people who fundamentally believes in humanity's good nature, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the behaviors that we see are not consciously malignant. If you were asked people directly, are you racist? Well, how many people openly say, yeah, I'm racist? They are outliers. They are in the fringes. They're in the peripheries. The majority of people believe themselves to be good people. There's a brilliant book by Dr. Dolly Chu. It's called The Person You Mean to Be. And it explores the fact that we believe ourselves to be good people. And people want to be, I believe, good people. But there are biases, there's hidden racism, there's the way in which we've been socialized, there's belief systems that are unexamined. That means that we make decisions about people, we make prejudgments about people, we hold prejudices about people. That means that we behave in ways that if it was explicit and shown to us, we'd never even believe that that was us making that decision. I remember when I was in practice at the bar, And the number of times where you'd have a defendant who in the cool light of day was shown their behavior that they conducted a few nights before under that influence of alcohol. And they were so inebriated, they couldn't believe that they had behaved and conducted themselves in that way. They would never have accepted that that was it. And I think so often it's the case that for many people, they find themselves behaving in ways that isn't even conscious. And so often what we have to point to is the results. So if you are not seeing representation at your senior leadership level, why is that? It's because decisions are being made. If you're not recruiting people into your organization, it's because decisions are being made, because there's bias in the system. So the reason why I have hope and optimism is because I must have hope and optimism. Is because this work otherwise is pointless. Mm-hmm. It's just an exercise in sort of a vacuous exercise in just wafting fresh air into the wind and blowing into the wind. I believe that people can change. I believe that people will change when we bring appropriate challenge and when we raise awareness to people of exactly the impact of their decisions. I believe that people can change and people do change when they can see and they can connect with the fact that the decisions that they're making now will impact generations to come and that they are role modeling certain behaviors. And I see changes happen when I'm in conversations with leaders. I see those aha moments, I see light bulb moments happen. And does that lead to immediate change? No, we're still stuck with a lot of the data that we're seeing, but I just have to have hope. I feel that we have to have hope. Otherwise it makes all of this an exercise in futility and you just become fatigued and you just become frustrated. So is the light dimming? I would say the light is still shining. Mm-hmm. The light is still shining.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And we say, you know, Priya and I both say hope over fear every time. You have to have it. Otherwise, you know, what is the point to exactly to what you just shared? What is the point of all this work that we're doing? And sometimes we allow the minority to take some of the stuff that we're doing and can really put us back. Whereas if you, to your point, majority of the people, even in our experience, Sharon, want to do good. Yeah. And they want to add value and they want to make sure everyone belongs. It just takes, to your point, addressing the biases, the system around us, and it takes a bit of intentional work. Thank you so much, Sharon. I have loved our conversation today. And as Priya said earlier, we could listen to you all day talking about this topic. You have such an incredible way of telling the story and doing it with such kindness. And that is sometimes something that is missing in the world that we're in, because people are frustrated, and rightly so. But if we can have a bit of hope, sprinkled with kindness, we can make great impact. And the conversation that you shared today has just demonstrated that for us as well. So thank you so much for your time. If people want to follow Sharon and connect with her work, I know Sharon does a regular newsletter, which you should definitely subscribe to. And you can follow her on LinkedIn. And we'll make sure that we share all of Sharon's contact details in our show notes as well. But thank you so much for your time, Sharon. We really appreciate the conversation and, of course, you.
An absolute pleasure. It's been wonderful spending time with you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to our A Leader Like Me podcast.
Find us on socials and at aleaderlikeme.com.
And please do read our new book, Building a Culture of Inclusivity, Effective Internal Communication for Diversity, Equity and Inclusion. You can buy our book from anywhere you buy your books online.
And a discount code for our listeners is available. Just use the code ALLME20 at www.koganpage.com.
And please do reach out for us for any internal communication, change management, and DEI communication training and support your organization needs.
We have keynotes, workshops, and consulting programs available. Email us at info@aleaderlikeme.com.